Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
I couldn't understand why there wasn't a lot of makeup for women of color. I never understood that because I had lots of friends of color. There was so much diversity, especially in New York. And so we developed colors that really worked on all people. We had like 35 foundation colors, from blue-black skins to the palest of porcelain skins. And we sort of covered everybody.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Beauty,
the podcast all about the best-selling beauty products and the damn good stories behind them. We're your hosts, Carlene Higgins
and Jill Dunn.
Hello everybody, welcome back to Breaking Beauty. This is Jill here.
This is Carlene.
So Canada Day is just upon us. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this show, Carlene, about some hot Canadian beauty brands.
Yeah, we've talked about Nude Sticks, Dessie M, Sage, The Seven Virtues.
Yeah, these have all been guests. These people, these brands have all been guests on our show. But I think we can both agree there's only one Canadian household name in the beauty biz.
Yeah, that even like my grandmother, if she were still here, would know the name of, and that is MAC Cosmetics.
Yeah.
So this was like a career making moment for Jill and I.
Yes.
To be able to sit down with Frank Toskin, co-founder of the original MAC Cosmetics, was just like dream come true.
Incredible. This is his first interview in 4 years. Mm-hmm. He is very much under the radar, does his own thing. He doesn't grant interviews a lot. Reason being, he's not involved in MAC Cosmetics in the day-to-day any longer. He sold the business to Estee Lauder. He and his co-founding partner, Frank Angelo, who has sadly since passed away, they sold MAC to Estee Lauder in what year was it? 1998.
Yeah. So Jill had to do some serious sleuthing.
I did what I do, which is just creep on the internet until I find something that I can use.
Until she finds a way.
Yes.
I love that about you.
But the thing was, we knew we could do this because he's right here in our backyard.
Yeah.
Let's set the scene where we were.
Yeah. So he actually lives in Toronto, and we sat down in his actual real life living room in a condo in Yorkville. We won't tell you more than that. We don't want, you know, super fans showing up at his door. But yeah, we were sitting on the sofa. His two dogs were there.
Yeah.
It was so intimate and very lovely. Relaxed. He is so warm.
Yeah.
Loved hanging out with him. We have photo evidence, and it looks like we've just woken up on Christmas morning. It's hilarious. We look like a family.
We're all like, gathered around the mic with the cup with the dogs.
Yeah.
And only thing that's missing is like the Russian red lipstick and the, and like the strobe cream.
They weren't too far away. But honestly, we talked for a really long time. So for the first time ever, we are releasing this very special episode in two parts.
Yeah. There was just so much great stuff. We had to share it.
Couldn't
and
leave it on the
so
cutting room floor.
He so rarely speaks to media.
Yeah.
We had to get this origin story into your guys's ears. Mm-hmm. There's just so much more than that. But let's start with a little bit of beauty school knowledge.
Yeah.
if people do not know, MAC was founded in 1984, and it stands for Makeup Art Cosmetics.
Its tagline is all ages, all races, all sexes. That was the original. It's now updated to be all races, all ages, all genders. So when you think about the fact that they launched with that in 1984, how progressive that truly was. I mean, that could be a tagline for a makeup brand launching today. And I'm sure internally that is so many brands' ethos, but they really are standing on the shoulders of a giant, which is MAC Cosmetics, who broke down barriers at retail level in people's minds.
They paved the way. There would be no Too Faced, probably no Fenty Beauty. MAC just came in and was like, We're just doing us. We're just going to have cross-dressers at our counter. We're going to have makeup in pots. Who's using those stupid sponges? We don't need those. They just were like rebellious.
And coming out with like millions of colors that people thought nobody would ever buy, because it was all about self-expression, not products you needed, but products that you wanted to be able to express who you truly were inside. And then you talk about cruelty-free. You talk about recycling back programs back to MAC. I mean, so incredibly progressive. And you've got to give credit where credit's due.
And like a tribe, an army of people. You knew the, you know, I remember one of Linda Wells' editor letters, one of my favorite ones she ever wrote at Allure, was talking about taking a trip to Toronto and seeing tribes of people dressed head to toe in black going to like a MAC conference. You know, you wanted to be part of that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't try hard. It was inclusive.
Yeah. Well, I remember myself in the early 90s, let's say, like playing with makeup, and there was no way that I was going to go out and buy any other brand. No. At the time, it was the only one that a young, cool person would use. Yeah. And I was obsessed with Twig lipstick. It was like a brownie, mauvey shade that, I mean, everybody wore it. And Spice lip liner, everybody wore it.
Yeah. And you're talking about, you know, super, super models of that day and that era to everyone. This was like when we were in high school, right? This is like the heyday or junior high or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, MAC is it's still leading the charge. It's still like the number one prestige brand, even though it's been sold, you know, it's in Estee Lauder's hands now.
Yeah.
The parent company. A MAC lipstick is sold every second around the world.
Yeah.
And it's best known for my favorite iconic shades like Ruby Woo. Remember even when Rihanna came out with her collection for MAC long before Fenty Beauty, she did Woo
at her own spin on it.
Yeah. And it was so great. It's like that bluish red. It's the best seller. There's four tubes sold every minute of Ruby Woo around the world. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about philanthropy.
And so in 1994, Viva Glam was born.
Yes.
They launched their very first special edition lipstick. It was a deep red, and it was completely unprecedented because 100% of the sales, every penny, went back to the MAC AIDS fund.
Yeah. And this isn't profits. This isn't proceeds. It's literally every dollar. Nobody took a commission. You're going to hear all about that later. But it's just so groundbreaking and celebrating 25 years next year.
Yeah.
So amazing. How much did they raise again? So
$480 million have gone to this cause. They have had, you know, top-notch celebrities that have come on board. RuPaul was the very first.
So great.
Love RuPaul and the perfect face. And again, Frank is going to tell us how that came together in the beginning. Katie Lang was another one. Doesn't even wear makeup.
No, a queer woman who doesn't wear makeup. Yeah. Like it, back in the day when all the models were like, Nikki Taylor.
Yeah.
And who else was like fronting beauty campaigns back then?
Cindy Crawford.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These fresh faced all-American girls wearing the glowy makeup. Yeah. And he's just like, no.
I mean, a brand with soul is what they were.
Exactly.
Like so much soul.
Yeah.
And it really does continue to today. And I think that is just so fantastic to see. Nicki Minaj has done Viva Glam, Miley Cyrus. MAC is sold in over 100 countries now. And starting this fall, they will actually enter Sephora.ca here in Canada. Yes. Can't say the same for the US, but you guys have Ulta. So that's going to be just one other place where we can find MAC. So that's a big milestone.
That's huge.
Them.
That is absolutely huge. We're going to hear so much from Frank, but we just want to make a note that we got a bit of a scoop while we were there because I was bugging him to make a Netflix documentary about Mac. And he said that actually somebody has recently written a book. It's called Viva Mac, AIDS, Toronto Fashion, and the Philanthropic Practices of Mac Cosmetics. It's written by Andrea Benoit, and it comes out in 2019, published by the University of Toronto. And stay tuned in part two of our interview series with Mac. We actually get the author herself on the phone to learn more about the project and the book.
Again, Mac's Canadian roots, they do remain strong. Many of the bestsellers are still manufactured right here in Markham, Ontario, mm-hmm. just outside of Toronto. The Mac lipstick, the Mac lip glass, yeah. another like fan favorite.
Did I ever tell you when I went to Markham?
No.
And I was there, it honestly wasn't that long ago.
Lucky
I think
girl.
It was like 2012 I was there.
Okay.
And I had the lab coat on and I was making my own lip glass. And I remember this like defining moment where you added the fragrance into your lip glass color, and it just brought you right back because it's that vanilla smell. That's something yeah. else that really made them stand out.
Yeah,
that smell went into all their lipsticks and yeah. to the lip gloss, which just created a whole other category.
Yeah, just another example of how they broke ground, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
do you guys have your Russian Red out right now? Put it on. Get your strobe cream.
Get your furry slippers out.
Your blot powder. You know, and we haven't even touched on how Mac created all the trends around the world basically for the last several decades.
Oh, and what about, you guys have to listen to the end because Frank is going to tell us all about his next indie startup
yes.
project.
Yes.
Which is, I'm a big fan of this brand and the products already.
Yeah, great.
And it will be touching down to South Beach
yeah.
starting in about a year. So I'm not going to give away any more than that. You're going to have to listen to part two.
Yeah. So that's going to drop tomorrow, the sequel. Mm-hmm.
We begin with Frank as a young child, a dreamer in every sense of the word.
Dig.
I'm Frank Toskin, and I'm the co-founder of Mac Cosmetics. I was born in a small town in what is now Slovenia, which used to be former Italy, which used to be former Yugoslavia. So that's where I was kind of sequestered for the first 6 years of my life with my grandparents, because my parents were refugees at that time, and my mom was in Italy. My father was sort of trying to get out of Yugoslavia. So I grew up with my grandparents. My grandmother was a dressmaker. So I sat beside her for endless hours. And that's, I think, where my interest in fashion and design came from. Sitting beside her, I started, using the little pedal sewing machine, and that's kind of like where I got, I think, a lot of my interest from my grandmother. Very soon after that, my parents decided to come to Canada. So my grandparents took me with my little suitcase, because that's all you were allowed to leave with in a communist country at that time. And they took me to the border, reunited me with my parents on the other side. And we spent a year in a refugee camp near Trieste, and my parents finally got an approval to come to Canada. So we landed in Halifax in 58. It was like this probably old ship that we came on, and everybody was vomiting because the seas were rough. And we landed in Halifax, and I think it was around the end of March, and it was gray and dark and cold, and we had just come from this sunny, bright, beautiful place in northern Italy. And it was kind of depressing. And we were put on a train, shipped out west to Calgary. My parents were put to work on a sugar beets farm. And their bubble was kind of burst at that time, because they came here for the better life. So here they found themselves farming from morning to sunset. And it wasn't what they expected. It was a hard hardship for them. At that time, they had to pay for their way over, so they had to work it off, their fare over here. And luckily, we came to they decided to come to Toronto, and they decided to go back to Italy. But we passed through Toronto, and they met some friends here, and we ended up staying here. So that's kind of like how we got here.
What does a five-year-old pack on a journey to a whole new world?
Well, I took a little toy that I still have, and it was a little push toy that you push with your finger from the bottom, and it was two people dancing around, and it was a little wooden toy, and I still have that. A little suit that was made by my grandmother, I didn't keep that, unfortunately, and I didn't keep the suitcase. I think the only thing I kept was a little toy. I'm glad that my parents did come here. I do feel displaced sometimes, though, because, you know, I still have, my first language was, first of all, it was Slovenian, and then it was Italian, and that's where I went to school for the first year of my life. It was a little odd for a young child to you know, to be thrown into grade one and try and understand how this system works. I remember a particular incident where the teacher was calling me by my name, and she was calling me Franco, and I would say, no, 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 mi chiamo Franco, not Franco. So I stopped responding to her, and I'm sure she hated me because I just would not answer to Franco. It taught my parents and myself, you know, how to fit in and how to adapt, and, you know, taught us a lot about hard work and the struggles that people have to go through. You know, we weren't privileged. My parents weren't privileged. They were also displaced. And, you know, we bonded together as a family, a unit, and that was invaluable for us, for the support that I later counted on my parents for, because they were there for me and I was there for them.
A person's first job is often seemingly random, but sometimes when you look back, you realize it was those small, invaluable lessons that can last a lifetime, as was the case with Frank.
My first job was making Christmas trees. I worked for Noma Manufacturing. They made Christmas trees and Christmas lights. And that was my first job. I had to lie about my age because I had to be 16 to work in the factory. I was 14. But in those days, nobody really questioned you or asked you for your passport or any kind of, certificate to prove that you were 16. So I ended up getting that job. I loved it. For the time, it gave me the money that I needed, and gave me the opportunity to buy my first car as soon as I turned 16. So there was freedom in working. My car was a Corvair Monza. I know. What is that? It was it's an old car, a little sports car that with a rusted floor. I remember I could see the street as I was driving, but I think it was probably about $250. Anyway, it did the trick. It got me from the suburbs to downtown Toronto. So that's all I needed. And nothing ever meant as much to me in my life again. I was able to get a Mercedes, and I was able to get better cars, but nothing gave me the excitement and the pleasure that cheap little rusted out Corvair Monza did.
Now we come to the next chapter, how the co-founders of Mac, Frank Toscan, and the late Frank Angelo, also known as the Two Franks, met.
I met Frank when I was around 21 at a dance club called the Manatee here. And I remember that we only had a couple of dance clubs as gay youth at that time in Toronto. And so we'd all hang out as a community in these two or three clubs that we had. And I remember I'd always catch a glimpse of Frank staring at me from far away the other side of the room. And one day I managed to, you know, get the nerve to go up to him and say, you know, what the hell are you looking at? You're starting to drive me crazy and bug me. And he said, I'm looking at you because I like you. And I said, oh, okay. And that was it. You know, it was that was the start of our relationship. You know, got to know each other, and we really liked each other, that was kind of like it. The world is a better place for having had someone like Frank Angelo here. He was back as a child. I know that he was a very precocious child. He started carving out his own career, I think, by the age of 9 or 10. He put a band together at the age of 12, and by the age of 14, he was recording, and by the age of 15, he was already traveling North America and performing. So he came to Toronto back in the 60s and met Blair James, who was a talented hairdresser at that time. And they started a place called The Haircutting Place, and it was the first ever of its kind. They did unisex haircutting, just at the time when the hippies with long hair were cutting their hair, and they didn't want to go to formal salons. I kind of like, you know, hung around and watched what everybody was doing, and I realized there was an opportunity there to step in and create a job and a role for myself. And I started doing photography. I knew he was buying like all these posters of haircuts because that's what the haircutting place was known for all of these haircuts that they developed. And every month they'd come out with new haircuts. I looked at these posters and I thought, well, I think I can do better than that. I went to hair school and I started learning how to cut hair and I started learning how to, you know, take photographs. And so I started producing some of these posters, which I started selling in other hair salons as well. Tacky posters at that time, but still interesting. It gave me a start and it gave me an insight into makeup and how light works with film. And so I learned a lot out of that that from that time. My stint at school was very short because I went to Bruno's and one day, you know, we would bring in, people came in off the street, it was, and we did their hair for free. So one day this very, this lady came in and she wasn't a really a nice person. Anyway, I was given her as a client and this is how we practice. And I put her in the shampoo chair and I forgot to put the cape behind the chair. So I shampooed her hair and without the cape being behind the chair, so all the water ran down onto the seat and she was soaking wet when she got up. And she screamed at me and she lost it in the store. And I kind of, and the teacher started, siding with her. And it was an honest mistake. That didn't go well and I walked out. So I never really got to finish hair school, but I got to know enough about it. So I didn't get to create great hairstyles. I was more an updo guy. I used to love doing updos and roller sets and pin curls, 9 o'clock pin curls, 3 o'clock pin curls and updos. That's what it was all about at that time.
If you walk by a MAC counter today, you'd never imagine that those bright and bold pots of eyeshadows, fluorescent lipsticks, and glittery glitters were born in Frank Toscan's kitchen. But that's exactly how the story goes.
When I started doing makeup, there wasn't really a lot on the market. You know, there was very limited product. I mean, most things were sold, eyeshadows were sold in little palette compacts of three colors, light, medium, and dark. And you know, it was like a paint by numbers approach that most cosmetic companies took. If you had red hair, you'd wear green eyeshadow with yellow tones. And if you had blonde hair, you could wear blues. And anyway, I found it very restricting. And I started going to Curry's and I started going to stores and starting to mix my own blend of colors. And I started to take brushes because there weren't brushes on the market at that time. Most people use sponge tip applicators or they use their fingers. That's the way makeup was typically applied back then. You know, and I couldn't find brushes, so I would go to like the art stores and find brushes that worked for me. Every type of product works better with a different type of a specific brush, whether it's if it's a wet product, it'll work better with a synthetic. If it's a dry product, it'll work better with a natural hairbrush. So, you know, I developed my own brushes and then sent them off and had them duplicated and they were a hit. Nobody was doing it at the time, really. It was you're younger than me, but I know my mother only used her fingers and or this little sponge tip applicator that came in the compacts at the time. I think they've done away with most of those things now because the industry has realized there's money to be made in brushes. And I think we also changed the face of makeup in terms of education. You know, when we launched MAC, it was about teaching people how to use products correctly and with the right tools, and that had never been done before. It was more cosmetic companies tend to sell product and that was the end of it. We brought people in, taught people how to use makeup and the tools that were right for what they wanted to achieve, and then they were your customers for life because you just helped them learn and be discriminating about the products that they bought.
MAC 1.0 quickly outgrew the kitchen sink, and as the word was getting out in the makeup artist community, the demand started to grow to the point where they opened their very first standalone pro store.
Our first pro store was on Parliament and Carlton, not a great area, and people wonder why we opened there, but the building was cheap, and Frank and I lived on the top floor. We had our office on the second floor. We had a beauty salon called MAC Hair on the main floor, and downstairs I did my makeup. In kind of private, and at that time it was I just really made and developed products for professionals, very, you know, raw products like things like pigments and things that makeup artists could use themselves and mix with mediums that they wanted to. And that just grew. I mean, the demand just grew. It was by appointment only when I was on my own there. And then all of a sudden we started packaging the products, and it just evolved.
How do homemade cosmetics go to the next level? We've said it before on Breaking Beauty Podcast, and we'll say it again. It's always good to know a chemist.
My sister was dating a chemist at the time, and I thought that, I brought him in and said, Vic, you know, I've got a challenge here for you. Do you think we can work on some products together? Vic had never made makeup before, so, you know, we went to the library, got some books, and we learned how to mix some products. I knew what I wanted, and he gave me the opportunity to actually see it to fruition. So then all of a sudden I was able to create products that had never been made before. And, people really embraced all this new creative opportunity that they had with makeup. I always loved makeup for the fact that it was playful, and I always felt it wasn't necessary to wear makeup. It was something that people did and used as an accessory to have fun with, but never did I sell products because I ever told anyone that they needed a product to make them look better. So we always took a very different approach in the way we sold our products. There was Frank, and then there was Vic, and then there was my sister, and then there was Rod Ulmer at the Bay, who embraced who we were and allowed us to come into the department store. And, you know, we didn't fit into the cosmetic department, but he wanted to give us a chance. You know, we were young and hungry and eager, and he thought we had something to offer, and he recognized that. And so he said, you know what, I'll give you a space on the second floor, back in the corner, and we'll see how you do there. And, I worked there. We had another two males working in there, and that was unheard of in those days to have guys working at the makeup department. We'd get our curious clients in, we'd do their makeup, they'd go back to the office, and all of a sudden the next day, like, there were 10 other women that came in saying, wow, you know, you did this for my friend yesterday, can you do this for me? And that just grew. It just grew and grew from that word of mouth. There's a lot of pressure in the cosmetic department to perform like everyone else, and it's very competitive, and you sell, you know, generally because of commission and pressure from the different brands to compete. So we didn't have that to worry about. We just worried about how to do what we did well.
It's 1985, and MAC decides it needs to go to the heart of the action. So it opens its first standalone store for consumers in New York City.
Christopher and Gay Street was the corner we opened on. Most people thought we were crazy for going down in Greenwich Village. They said, you know, this is not where you start, right? But we knew that there was a vibe there, and there was a creative energy in that area. It's where all the drag queens lived. It's where kind of like the underground scene was percolating at the time, and there was so much change and excitement in that area. You know, the other areas of New York were really established. So that's kind of what fit our personality at the time. And, it was a very exciting time. We had, celebrities started coming in. We had, we hired drag queens like Lady Bunny and Lady Miss Guy. RuPaul was in the store. Lady Miss Keir would come in. I think even Lady Gaga would be at the window peeking in because she was too young at the time. I heard a story of that. She would come down to the store and just look at all the drag queens and wish she was old enough to come in and wear the makeup and just participate. So there was a real energy and a vibe. Within a year, we had busloads of people coming down from uptown, because we became kind of like the show on Saturdays and Sundays. And it was an exciting time. None of what we did was really calculated. It all just evolved and developed from who we were as people. And all the thoughts and all the ideas came from all different aspects of life. And, you know, for all races, all sexes, first of all, I couldn't understand why, there wasn't a lot of makeup for women of color. I never understood that because I had lots of friends of color. So, there was so much diversity, especially in New York. And so we developed colors, and that was part of our success as well. We developed colors that really, worked on all people. We had like 35 foundation colors, from blue-black skins to the palest of porcelain skins. And all gamuts, from cools, green undertones, yellow undertones, red undertones, and we sort of covered everybody's, you know, skin tone in our range of foundations.
We've talked a lot about the trend toward 40 foundation shades on the podcast recently. Of course, when we say trend, we don't mean trendy. We just mean what's happening in the industry right now. But MAC was really leading in this category toward inclusive skin tone shades from the very beginning. Curiously, though, MAC's strategy wasn't as much about the quantity of shades available. It was more about giving people the tools to make their own match.
So we were early on, we were doing it we didn't have the ability to package that many skin tones. So we were doing it by selling pigment, and people were able to mix their own pigments, which really, it allowed them to participate in making their own products as well to some degree. And that was kind of interesting. We would sell like yellow pigment or blue pigment or red pigment, so you could mix it into your foundation and alter it. Because you don't need that many different products. I mean, you could take a skin cream and mix it into your foundation. You could stretch your foundation by mixing it into, you know, like a different medium. So we always tried to limit the number of products we had by utilizing, you know, different mediums. Cover Effects is a line that I started with my brother-in-law after we sold MAC. And it's in the market today, and it has incredible foundation shades, and also offers the same type of philosophy. Like, you can buy a shiny pigment and use it in your foundation, you can use it in your skin cream, you can use it dry, you can use it wet, you can use it in so many ways.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of Breaking Beauty Podcast. You've now heard the origin story behind how MAC Cosmetics came to be.
So tune in to part two, dropping in your feeds tomorrow, where you will hear the epic story behind Viva Glam, juicy celebrity nuggets, hello Madonna, and the indie startup that Frank Toscan is cooking up next.